Hi, this is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube, and this is part of our Remembering Ornette podcast series, and I thought that I would go first. The format we're going to use on these calls is pretty simple. We're going to ask our guests some background history on how they came to music and then how they met Ornette, what it was like working with him, and the impact that had on their life. And we'd also like to get some updates on their current career. So, like I said, I'm going to go first. So I got exposed to jazz when I was in high school. I heard that Kinda Blue was a great album, so I bought it, and I was amazed. I had not much exposure to jazz until then, but I guess I knew quality when I heard it. And I guess my next bunch of albums were Billie Holiday albums with Lester Young, some Verve re-releases that were just, again, astonishing. So I stayed interested in jazz when I was in college. I got involved in producing jazz concerts. My roommate for 1 year was the then not known Stanley Jordan. Some people may recognize his name. He's a very talented and accomplished jazz guitarist. When we were juniors, I think, there was a jazz class, which this is way back in 1978, so that was pretty avant-garde for a college to give credit for a class on jazz history. And I forget the professor that ran it, but he collaborated with Benny Carter, the great Benny Carter. So we had the amazing experience of meeting with, talking with, hanging out with, listening to Benny Carter for a semester. And Stanley actually did a gig with Benny Carter and Dizzy Gillespie. It was pretty amazing. So fast forward to the paper that we had to write for the class, and having been born in 1959 and knowing that Kinda Blue came out in 1959, I thought, all right, I'm gonna write about what was going on in jazz in 1959. So I went up to the Rutgers University Jazz Institute Library, thinking that was the best place to go, and indeed it was, and I started reading through all the news clippings and magazines from that period. And of course, Miles was clearly a huge deal in 1959, but I kept reading all these stories about this guy named Ornette Coleman. Now, I knew Ornette's name. I'm sure I'd heard his music, but I didn't have the ears for it, I think, and so it didn't really stick with me at the time. But the more and more I was reading these news clippings, the more fascinated I became, and the Jazz Institute had a collection of LPs, and I just started playing the early LPs, Something Else, The Shape of Jazz Time, The Change of the Century, and I was just floored. I could hear it. To me then and to me now, Ornette on alto sounds like Charlie Parker cue. In other words, Charlie Parker built the whole new world for musicians to walk into, and Ornette walked in and then walked through the walls. So I kind of explained Ornette's playing. And, the virtuosity of his alto playing is just, it's otherworldly. But, of course, it's the result of intense study and intelligence and focus. So I became fascinated by Ornette Coleman, and I started listening to his music all the time. And it came to be senior year, and I managed to connive my way into a field study program, which basically let me get out of school for a semester. And my field study was to go to Manhattan and study jazz culture. And how I got away with that, I don't know, but I'm very pleased that I did. I lived a whole bunch of different places. Again, remember, this is 1980, when New York was a little bit rough around the edges. I lived on East 95th Street, when that was not a pleasant place. I lived in Williamsburg, when that was definitely not a pleasant place. I got a job as an intern at the New York State Council on the Arts, and I had had an internship before there when I was in high school, but this time I worked in the music department, and I worked for James Jordan, and some people will recognize James as Ornette's cousin. And the whole reason I got that job was on the hope that I might, on an off chance, get 2 seconds to say hello to Ornette Coleman. That was the whole reason I took that job. And as things would have it, it was a very interesting time. Again, it was 1980. Ornette was looking to buy a building in Manhattan. Now, that may seem outlandish today, but believe me, in the late 70s and 1980s, early 1980s, it wasn't so impossible to buy a building in Manhattan, especially in the right neighborhood. The city was beat down about as far down as it could be beaten, and it was, like I said before, it was kind of a rough place in those days. So James said, Ornette's been trying to buy this building, but, he's talking with realtors, and they're all giving him a runaround. Now, Ornette is not necessarily the most traditionally, conventionally business-like person on earth. Let's just say that, right? So I can imagine, now I can imagine the difficulties he had with so-called business professionals. But then again, at that time I didn't know him. So I was kind of outraged. I thought, are you kidding me? You know, these people aren't bending over backwards to help them. I'll find the building. Now, I had been taking classes in real estate, and I thought, of course, at age 20 that I knew everything. So next thing I knew, I was talking to Ornette on the phone. James connected me with him. And I said, Ornette, I think I can help you find a building. And he said, okay. 20 years old, I'm going to find a building in Manhattan. So we had a meeting set up at his place on the Bowery. Some people may know Ornette had a loft on Prince Street in pre-Soho. And again, it's hard to imagine what Soho was like before the big boom. It was pretty much abandoned. Beautiful buildings, but there was nobody home. And Ornette had a place there. Somehow, he lost it. I never really understood what happened. I think it had to do with some maneuverings on the part of the other owners or tenants. I'm not really sure what it was. But as the neighborhood got better, they started to look at the building with dollar signs in their eyes. And Ornette had an open door policy, which means, anybody could basically arrive at any time and stay and visit and play music. And I guess the fellow owners of the building wanted him out, and out they got him indeed. He this is part of history, so I'm going to share it. He ended up temporarily taking shelter, essentially, in the storeroom of a record company, the name of which I will not mention for reasons that will be obvious later. And that was his home for a while because he didn't have another plan. And even in those days, it was a little hard to get an apartment. Not too long after that, he got a loft on the Bowery. And trying to remember exactly where it was. It was definitely south of Houston, had to be. And I think it was just a hair north of Rivington. And it was a 2- or 3-story building, an old building, completely unrenovated. It did not even have central heat. It had a pot-bellied stove. And, again, this is part of history. Ornette was feeding that stove in the winter with scraps that came from the pallets of the garment industry, which was still pretty big in the city at the time. And I remember one night Carl Berger from the Creative Music Studio and his students came down with huge amounts of firewood for him. So he was well taken care of, but he was heating the place with a pot-belly stove. So anyway, I'm standing out in front of the address on Bowery and thinking, oh my God, I'm going to meet Ornette Coleman. I'm getting a little scared here because, listening to the music and not knowing the man, I was kind of expecting a fire-breathing dragon. Not that I thought he was a bad guy, but he was obviously going to be this larger-than-life superhuman force, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to deal with it, So after a little while, this gentleman walks up to the door. He's got a cheesecake under his hand, and in the most gracious and polite and gentle way introduces himself. Hi, I'm Ornette Coleman. And it was like, wow, this is Ornette Coleman. This is amazing. So we went upstairs to the loft, and the cheesecake was for the band, Primetime. And this was a rehearsal day, and so the cheesecake was for one of the breaks. And the band at that time was DiNardo, of course, on drums, Calvin, oh my goodness, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. Marvelous, Calvin Weston, marvelous drummer. Someone leading Takuma on bass, Al McDowell on bass, Vern Nix on guitar, and Charlie Ellerby on guitar. So, everybody milled around for a little while, and then they set up, and Ornette just took a folding chair and put it right in the middle of the loft, and I sat down, and for the next 5 hours or so, I got to watch Primetime work, and it was very interesting. I can't call it a rehearsal because there was very little communication. In fact, I don't remember any communication. I just remember them setting up and going and just playing and playing and playing and playing, playing and playing, and it went on and on and on. And I actually had the same experience with Cecil Taylor, coincidentally. I had been working at Indian Navigation Records, if anybody remembers that company. Beth Cummins, who was Bob Cummins' daughter, had been managing it, and then she needed to do some other stuff, so I volunteered to take over watching the office and answering the phone and going to the pressing plant, bringing back the records, all that kind of stuff. And Cecil Taylor at that time had a loft near Chamber Street, and it was being renovated, and he needed a place to practice, so he practiced in our studio. And this is a bit of a sidebar, but it might be interesting to people. He arrived. He's wearing a sweatsuit, with sparkles on it. And he played nonstop, no break, no breath, for 3 hours, just full out, like going, you know. And then Jimmy Lyons showed up, and they worked together for maybe 2 hours. So now we're up to 5 hours. And then the rhythm section showed up. And these were younger guys, newer guys, and there was a little bit of conversation about things. And that went on. Well, I finally had to bail out. So I left. They had been rehearsing 8 hours nonstop. I'm not adding an hour to it. It was an eight-hour rehearsal. We're working together, and I finally had to go home, so I have no idea how long they rehearsed. So if anybody's ever seen Cecil or Annette and wonder where all that energy is coming from, you're just seeing the tip of the top of the iceberg. That's what they're doing when they're working all day, when they're working. So anyway, back to prime time. So I'm sitting there, and I'm on the seventh level of heaven here watching this. It's just unbelievable. All right, so then I went out and I started looking for buildings. And as luck would have it, the New York City was auctioning off some surplus buildings that they owned. And one of the buildings they owned was a huge public school building on Rivington Street, at the very end of Rivington Street, right by the projects. And it was old school, old kind of construction, 55,000 square feet. There were 55 classrooms, each one roughly about 1,000 square feet. There was an auditorium. There was an industrial kitchen. There was a smallish gymnasium. And, you know, the walls were about 20 feet thick. I mean, everything was built of stone. You could hit it with a bomb, and I don't think it would even shake. There were probably some electrical and plumbing problems, but the bones of that thing were amazing. So Ornette and I walked down Rivington Street. I showed him the building. I said, "What do you think?" He said, "Okay." A week later, the auction came. And like I said, no one will say that Ornette is a conventional business person, and I think he's a bit nervous or timid about dealing with that kind of stuff, and for good reason. And so he said, "I want you to do the bidding." And I said, "Okay, you know, again, 20 years old, what do I know? I'm bulletproof. I can do anything at 20, right?" So I was a bit crafty, and I just sat back and I let people bid. And he kept looking at me, wondering why I wasn't bidding. And they kept bidding it up. And finally, they kind of ran out of gas. And that's when I put in our bid, which, believe it or not, a 55,000 square foot building for, I believe, $325,000. That is not a misprint. That's exactly what the thing went down for. Now, you may say that was the bargain of the century. And in retrospect, in hindsight, absolutely, that building is probably worth about $30 million today. But at the time, $325,000 was a lot of money. And I knew, because I kind of knew the real estate market. Just to give you a comparison, in those days, you could have bought a three-bedroom apartment with a doorman in the East 80s near Lexington for about $100,000. All right, I don't know what that would cost today, but you know, well north of $1 million. So this was not a small amount of money. And being 20 years old and being 20 years old kind of explains everything. I didn't read the contract for the auction carefully, and I didn't note that Ornette had to come up with 25% deposit right away. And that caused some consternation, say the least. Now, he did have the money, but it was a strain. And all of a sudden, I realized, my God, what have I done? You know, what have I gotten this guy into? My hero, you know? And I think there was some, you know, I don't know. I mean, the family, I think, you know, I think Donardo was very happy with me. I don't think James Jordan was very happy with me. But I thought, hey, you know, this is what Ornette asked for. We got this amazing building. Yeah, it's going to be a stretch, but, you know, it's doable. It's doable. So one of the things that happened was on the ground floor of this building, there was a school, a sort of private school that this a Muslim lady, but a black Muslim lady, was running for kids in the neighborhood called, I think it was called the Lower East Side International School. And she was kind of a squatter, I believe, maybe a political squatter. You know, she kind of got in there and then political wherewithal to stay there. And when she found out the building was sold, she understandably became worried because she didn't want her school to be booted out. So Ornette and I went and had a meeting with her, and she was kind of prickly about things. And I, again, being 20 years old, was kind of prickly in return. And, you know, Ornette cooled me out, and this was the beginning of my great education. He just sort of talked to me afterwards and explained to me how to do things correctly. And this was all revelation to me. I really didn't have much social grace or emotional resilience or tolerance or patience at that age. I really hadn't seen much of it in my own life. And it was just a blessing to have somebody educate me on the need for that. So the school went forward. Obviously, if anybody's seen the movie Ornette Coleman Made in America, there's a scene with Robert Palmer and George Russell, and they're all sitting around talking about music, and that is inside the school. Actually, there's even a whole section in the movie where Ornette's laying out his dreams and his hopes for the school. Obviously, that it never came to pass, and which is very unfortunate. There were some incidents there, I think, that made him justifiably feel unsafe. That neighborhood was rougher than rough. I mean, you might as well have been in Beirut during the wars. I mean, I saw a knife fight in a playground on my way to the building once. I mean, it was a tough place, which is why the building was available for so little. So that was one of our adventures. And while I'm thinking about this, this is probably maybe the most important thing. Not only did Ornette take time, and we spent a lot of time together for a few months because there was a lot of stuff involved in dealing with that building, obviously. And he spent a long time educating me, sometimes overtly, you know, just explaining, you know, just how to be with people. But also, I saw him, how he was with people, and it was a revelation. I don't think I've ever seen anyone, I certainly didn't see anyone before that, and I've seen very few people since that who gave himself over completely to listening to other people. It was amazing. And any ability that I have to listen to people today, I have to attribute entirely to him. Because talking about setting a standard, I mean, when you talked with him, there was no other thing going on in the universe, as far as he was concerned, but what you were saying. And that is a beautiful trait to cultivate and develop. Obviously, he had it, not only with people, but we know with music, too. One of the things I want to say about that rehearsal, going back to, and again, it's not really a rehearsal, because it wasn't like he said, okay, we're going to work through this tune. They just played and played and played. And again, I think I'm the one that bailed out. I think after 5 hours, I went back to my apartment in Williamsburg, Williamsburg 1980, not Williamsburg of the hipster era. It was amazing. And of course, the music, it's incredible. At the memorial, the final procession, the primetime band, and Takuma was there, and Ellerby was there, and Nix was there, and Donardo was not there, obviously. He was with the procession. But it was just so great to hear that band again. They played music for the processional out at the end of the memorial. Okay, other experiences with Ornette. Well, his place was a crossroads. One night, David Byrne and Don Cherry came by. Just all kinds of amazing people came by. So that was definitely interesting. This is sort of a historical event that probably should be documented. And I'm not going to mention too many names or details, but somehow Ornette's entire life's work up to that time, and this is now 1980, roughly the midpoint of his professional public career, his entire life's work was in the office of a record company. And I don't really know I certainly didn't know the details then, and I certainly don't know the details now. But he was a bit upset about that, and he wanted to get that stuff back. This was a pile of reel-to-reel tapes in white boxes, about 4 feet high and about, 12, 14, 16 feet long. I mean, this was a massive quantity of stuff. And he told me, yeah, there's tapes of me and John Coltrane. And then he said there was a tape of him and Bud Powell and Cecil Taylor, with Cecil Taylor and Bud Powell switching off at piano. And something that should go down on the record is Ornette had boundless admiration for Cecil, for Cecil, of course, but just boundless admiration for Bud Powell. He made it really clear to me that Powell was just, beyond the beyond. And that kind of opened my mind up to listening to Bud Powell. And if anybody hasn't really dived into his music, I recommend it. And if you can, even if you can't play piano, you can pack out notes. Just try to copy one of his licks, and you'll be there all day. They sound so fluid, and they sound so simple. And then you try to reproduce them, and it's like, my God, where did this come from? Kind of like Ornette's playing, really. So anyway, he was concerned about this situation. And he asked me if I would help, and, you know, I'm 20 years old, I'll do anything. So we rented a truck, I think at the ABC Truck Company on 14th Street, and we drove up to this place, and I brought a friend along, and we got in, you know, we had keys, and, you know, there was no break or enter or anything like that, and we just piled all this, his life's work into these big garbage cans, you know, that was plastic ones, clean, you know, it was just the most convenient way to carry this stuff, and we loaded it all down. I watched the truck while they did the carrying, and we repatriated Ornette Coleman's life work up to that point back to the loft on Bowery. You know, I saw Ornette quite a bit from then until, you know, recent years. I would, you know, I'd be in town, I'd give him a call maybe once every other year. We just talk about stuff. I was spending a lot of time in New Orleans in the after the flood, and we talked a lot about his time in New Orleans. I think that's historically important, and I think there is a paucity of good information about his time there. There's a lot of debate about how long he was in New Orleans, but I believe, from what he told me, it was a good long stretch. He was living in the Lower Ninth Ward, which is became famous after the flood. And just a sidebar, the Lower Ninth Ward is not lower than sea level. The Lower Ninth Ward was devastated because levees built by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers failed. It had nothing to do with weather. It had nothing to do with sea level. And a very vibrant, beautiful neighborhood was scraped. And if anybody ever was down in New Orleans after the flood and went in that neighborhood, I mean, now it's looking normal, but the place, it was just scraped. Like, houses were lifted and carried a block. Cars were lifted blocks and stacked on each other. It was just unbelievable. But that was all the result of this wall just suddenly collapsing. But anyway, that neighborhood was very, you know, it's in the South, you know, so, you know, the vegetation was just everywhere. You know, it was jungly. You know, it was really a green place. So Ornette lived there with the Lask family, and Melvin was a very, very fine trumpet player who befriended Ornette and invited him to stay with his family, which he did. And Ornette, I have a tape somewhere. I have a couple of tapes. One, just some conversations we had about all kinds of stuff. But I do have a short tape of us talking about his time in New Orleans. And he said, you know, no gigs really for him then. But he played in church a lot. And I believe it was the spiritual church. And there's a, you know, tradition down there. It's a church city. I mean, New Orleans is a church place. And in these services, at a certain point, the music starts, and it just goes. And it goes wherever, and people do whatever. And in that context, Ornette would play. And he said to me, and he said it another time, I think he even said it in the movie Made in America, he said that it was in that time, in that experience, where he realized that he really could play whatever he wanted, whatever he felt, whatever he thought, and it would be accepted. In other words, it was his first taste of acceptance of him playing the way he wanted to play. And he said, I was playing real free back then. You know, this is pre-LA, right? Everybody who knows the story knows that he was out in LA in the 50s, and that's where he met Charlie Hayden, and I believe Don Cherry, and of course he met Ed Blackwell in New Orleans. But that's basically where he hooked up with musicians, simpatico musicians, and built the foundation of his early career, where he, you know, recorded those amazing records for Contemporary and Atlantic, and came to New York, and you know, just basically changed the world of jazz. I mean, think about it. Ornette enabled jazz musicians to express themselves better. I mean, you know, it's like somebody teaching poets how to be more poetic, or rocket scientists how to be more precise. His music, his art, went into an already incredibly creative arena and opened up new doors of creativity. I think that's his artistic legacy. And if you just think about it, jazz was very well developed when he appeared. You know, there was nothing unsophisticated about it. It had reached a really, really high point. And he came in and he shook it up. And I'm pretty sure this is common knowledge, and I think it's accurate. I think Sonny Rollins heard Ornette and said, you know what, I need to step back a little bit, do some, go to the woodshed and work on some things, because I realized I got into a bit of a rut. And a lot of musicians said that. I know John Coltrane went to Ornette for lessons. When John Coltrane died, and Coltrane had the advantage of knowing, I mean, the dubious advantage of knowing that he was dying, and he was very meticulous about writing out his plans for his memorial, and the musician that he wanted to play at his memorial was Ornette, and in fact, Ornette Coleman played at John Coltrane's memorial. You know, it's just they were, and I believe somewhere John Coltrane is quoted as saying that the most intense musical experience he ever had in his life was playing with Ornette, and I don't doubt it. I think a lot of musicians would say that. I'm kind of coming to the end of my recollections of him. There's Ornette the human being, and there's Ornette the creative giant. Strangely, when I think of Ornette, I just think of Ornette the human being, and then I'm reminded, oh yeah, and he did all this amazing stuff, and I love this music. He was really that kind of a person that you would, if you knew him, you would really be thinking more about him, the person, and the artistic and creative contributions obviously were there and on a massive level, but you'd be more thinking about him as a person. The memorial that I was lucky to be able to go to is down at Riverside Church, and I'm going to try to scan this, it's a program that so you can see what went on, but I'm just going to read some of the people that performed. Pharoah Sanders performed. Cecil Taylor performed amazing stuff. Henry Threadgill and Jason Moran played. Yoko Ono spoke. Jerry Allen and Ravi Coltrane performed. Jack DeJohnette, and a guy that I don't know, but is an amazing dancer named, pardon me if I'm messing up this, I don't have my glasses, Savoir Gobert? I don't know, but amazing dancer. David Murray played with Joe Lovano, Al McDowell, Charnette Moffett, and Donardo Coleman. The final recessional was primetime with Jawaharlal Kuma, Charlie Ellerbe, Vern Nix. I might mess up some of these names because I'm afraid I don't know these guys. Ken Wessel, Chris Rosenberg, and David Breyart. But Roy was supposed to perform, but he didn't actually make it, I guess. The program went on for about 3.5 hours. It was beautiful. A lot of people got up and talked about their reminiscences of Ornette, and it was interesting to hear from family members and neighborhood friends. And there was one guy roughly my age, a little older, but roughly my age, and he was a friend of Donardo's, and you know, Ornette used to take, Ornette was just like a regular guy. He went on vacations, and because Donardo and this fellow were so close, he used to take this kid with him, and he said, this is a story that just to me is pure Ornette, and I'm going to end with this. They were down in the Virgin Islands, and the boys, who were boys at the time, they were young guys, really young, were just sitting on the beach, and then all of a sudden, Ornette apparently came out of nowhere, running full blast to the ocean, and jumped in with what they said was a perfect dive. And Ornette didn't swim. Ornette didn't know how to swim. How would you learn how to swim living in Fort Worth? And then L.A. So to me, that's just, I don't know why, but that if I have to remember the nature and the spirit of Ornette Coleman, it would be, one, him being willing to dive into the ocean not knowing how to swim, and two, him using his instinct, the highest form of thought, unimpeded by, limited thinking. Because that was discussed, by the way, at the memorial, that you can't, there's thinking, and we need to think if we're balancing our checkbooks and building bridges and all that kind of stuff. But when it comes to music or any kind of art, you can't think fast enough to play music. You have to be accessing your being on a whole different level. And it's not I just have this wild instinct and I just do everything right. No, it takes a lot of discipline to give oneself over to that other way of being. Ornette was clearly one of the grand masters, not only of doing it, but of helping other people do it. So this image of him running down to the beach and making a perfect dive into the ocean on his first try, not knowing how to swim, that was him, And the last thing I want to say, and I've said it before, and I think it can't be said enough, this was a man of just tremendous kindness and very concerned about other people finding their voice, their authentic voice. This was a huge huge theme in his life. In fact, it was one of the very first things that he talked with me about when we met. He was kind of bewildered at how many people were just completely cut off from themselves and therefore their ability to express themselves. And this was a big puzzle to him. And he worked his whole life not only to liberate himself in that area, but also to help liberate other people. And he was a giant on so many levels. So that's my remembrances of Ornette Coleman.